Scotch and Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films and television programs, Kajillionaire, Misbehavior, Enola Holmes, The Secret Society of Secondborn Royals, and Pen 15 Season 2. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the box office and the trailer park, as well as the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at Clue and the original The Hound of the Baskervilles. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is how much Mulan actually made. There was a report that came out from Yahoo about a week ago that estimated that it made somewhere close to $270 million in its Disney Plus subscriptions. Now, they got that number by looking at the number of downloads and how many people did it, and Yahoo had some sort of analytics working on it, and it basically said that about 9 million accounts downloaded the movie for $30. Later, there was a retraction from Yahoo, and it was published, I believe, in The Atlantic, and talked about that number being off, and being off considerably. And the number actually was somewhere between 60 to 90 million. And they pointed out that they're using terms like flopper and that didn't work. Well, look, $60 to $90 million is nothing to sneeze at. That is absolutely a good amount to make on a on-demand release in your first week and a half. I think one of the things that they're struggling with, it was $30 instead of $20. And so I imagine that they may have found what the upper limit is. I'll be curious to see if they release anything new, more on that later, on Disney Plus as a premium for like 20. I think some people probably balked at the $30 price tag. And Disney, they were taking a risk with that. They knew that already, considering so many other movies were rocking it in at $20. Why not? But I think it was worth Disney checking that out because they wanted to see. And the biggest problem with it is it's not doing well overseas. It's not doing terribly well in China. It's made about 60 million, which puts its total somewhere between 120 and 150 million right now. It's going to be struggling to make that $200 million budget back. But of course, you're still going to have Blu-rays and merchandising and everything else that Mulan is going to bring in. There are also some minor controversies about it that were more about the cultural aspects of China and some imprisonment of, I believe, Muslims in the area, and Disney still filmed in that area. And some things that the star of the film said about the police in Hong Kong. So there were some political quagmires to filter through its release in the Middle Kingdom, which I think is affecting that as well. But with that in mind, it makes total sense when you look at the next piece of news, and that is a massive move off the release schedule. The biggest one is, of course, Black Widow. They finally, as everyone was predicting, they finally moved Black Widow. They just said, the heck with it, it's not even going to be in 2020, it's going to 2021. May 7th, 2020, almost a year exactly to the date from when it was supposed to come out this year. They did the same thing with West Side Story, Spielberg's version of West Side Story. They moved that. They moved Eternals. They moved Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings. They've moved all of those Marvel movies and shoved them along the release date. And they have put in some of the 20th Century Fox releases like The Kingsman, but that doesn't hit until February. Which is quite a ways out, still, if you recall. They also took the Death on the Nile release, and they moved that to right before Christmas on December 18th. They are clearing their schedule. They're saying, hey, we're not dropping the blockbusters right now, and that's important because the industry is still changing and adapting to this new model, and Disney's not going to wait. Now, they've kept Soul on the release schedule to release the same week as No Time to Die, but I think they're also going to be looking to see what happens in the next couple weeks in theaters. They may do a day-and-date release of in theaters and Disney Plus. Who knows? That's actually, I think, where James Bond's going to end up going. They're going to release it in theaters and on demand either right in the same day or within a week of each other, maybe give you like an exclusivity for a week or two in theaters and then drop it on demand just because they want to make that money. And that's an international movie. So we still have not seen the end of what's happening with the blockbuster release schedules. The next piece of news I want to hit really quickly is actually I got a call from, I think his name was Bucky. I couldn't understand terribly well on the voicemail, but he was asking about the movie Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. And I'm going to just respond to you here because you say you listen every Saturday. This movie is almost 9 years old, so I'm not worried about talking about the ending. If you've seen it, it's of course about Elizabeth Olsen as a woman who's in a cult and then has to get saved from the cult, and they're trying to deprogram her. Now, in particular, the ending has confounded several people because they don't know exactly what's going on. Is the cult coming back to look for her, or is she free and is this in her own mind? And the reality is, unfortunately, it's one of those movies that it's meant to be ambiguous. You don't know. But it's not meant to be as a, you know, I'm so clever ambiguous the way Christopher Nolan did with Inception. This might be in this woman's head because she has been so affected by this cult. That's what the ending means to me. And if I'm not hitting the right part, I apologize, but that seems to be what it is. It's ambiguous, but it's meant to be ambiguous. And unfortunately, that's what you get with some movies sometimes. And it works for this one because it is about somebody playing with somebody's psychology and what they can believe and what they believe is real. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to talk about is Freaky, which is scheduled at least for a release on November 13th.
Honestly, if this was a horror movie, I'd be one of the first ones to get killed.
Cue the creepy dude in the mask.
But actually, it turns out...
Where am I?
I didn't get killed.
Oh my God, why do I sound like that?
I woke up in the killer's body.
The Blissfield Butcher strikes again.
It's a slaughterhouse.
I have like less than 6 hours to swap back or I'm going to be stuck in his body forever.
This is done by the people who did Happy Death Day. And I actually love this idea because as much as a fan I am of the 80s slasher movies, and I'll be the first to admit, you know, like stuff like Friday the 13th, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, all those are sort of high quality, normal slasher movies. But there were so many other ones like The Mutilator and Prom Night and all these other sort of imitative ones that were nothing more than a slice and dice. Those are kind of fun to watch now for nostalgia purposes, but they really weren't great movies. What I like about Freaky is it adds something different to it. The idea of this body swap, which is essentially what they did with Happy Death Day. They said, okay, we're going to do this slasher movie, but we're going to have a time loop in it. And that worked. I liked that. I thought that breathed fresh life into the slasher genre. And Freaky looks like it might be doing the same thing. The next one I want to hit is the only release that we're probably going to get from Marvel in 2020, and that is WandaVision, which is going to be on Disney Plus.
Wanda and Vision, aren't we a five pair?
This is our home now. I want us to fit in.
Oh, this is going to be a gas!
Where did you two move from? How long have you been married, and why don't you have children yet?
We are an unusual couple, you know.
Oh, I don't think that was ever in question.
This is, of course, the Scarlet Witch and Vision. It seems to be this sort of surreal world that they're living in, but they're trying to put something greater of an experience to it. It looks like it's going to be sort of like a romantic comedy that's playing off of the Ozzie and Harriet type sitcoms from the 50s and 60s. Which I grew up with. I grew up in the 70s, but a lot of the stuff that was rerun at the time was, you know, stuff like Bewitched and My Three Sons and The Brady Bunch. All that kind of stuff was being rerun. So I have a great affinity for the sitcoms of the 60s. So this one looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. I am looking forward to it and eagerly waiting for Disney Plus to drop it on the service. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Kajillionaire and Enola Holmes. and welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Kajillionaire. A small-time grifter family finds themselves pulled in multiple directions when a new person wants to join in on the score.
Most people want to be kajillionaires. That's the dream. That's how they get you hooked. Hooked on sugar, hooked on caffeine. Ha ha ha, cry, cry, cry. Me, I prefer to just skim.
So do I.
They are real characters, super unique. But you vouch for them, right?
She learned to forge before she learned to write. Oh, actually, that's how she did learn to write.
My favorite movies are the Ocean 11 movies.
This is exactly the kind of thing that I've been wanting.
This is the new film by Miranda July. I'm not terribly familiar with her work, but she's an independent filmmaker. And this makes a lot of sense because when you look at the movie like Kajillionaire, there's been a bunch of these films that have come out recently that I would describe as they look like 90s independent films. Something that would have been shot on 16 millimeter in the early 90s and would have like released like 93, 94. There was this whole resurgence of independent filmmaking back in the 1990s. That was highlighted by people like Spike Lee, although he was in the 80s, and Kevin Smith, and Richard Linklater, and even Steven Soderbergh, all the way through the late 80s with stuff like, his film like Sex, Lies, and Videotapes that move on. But this is what Kajillionaire feels like, and they have a certain quirky strangeness to them. And I mean, I don't know how they filmed Kajillionaire. It looks pretty much sedate and it's not a exactly bright palette, but it's not a vibrant piece and it's not meant to be, but it's one of those movies that takes place in LA and sort of the LA is used like a character. And I hate that expression, but what's interesting is I was watching it at one point. I was watching a screener of it and my son walks through the room and I point to it and I said, this street corner where they filmed it, this is just a typical LA street corner. Now, the only people who recognize that are either people who are from LA or people who have been to LA enough to recognize a street corner like that. Cause it just looks like LA. And the story is very intimate. It's about this family, Richard Jenkins and Deborah Winger, who Deborah Winger, by the way, I watched the entire movie, did not know it was her until the credits rolled. But they play the parents, and they're, when I say grifters, that gives them a little bit too much panache. I mean, we're not talking about like the grifters with John Cusack and Annette Bening back in the 90s. We're talking about grifting 20 or 30 bucks. These are the people that will try to return a coupon at McDonald's so they could get just a free Big Mac. These are the kind of people, they literally at one point check the coin slot at the bottom of a payphone. I mean, they found a payphone in LA, which is impossible to do anyways. And then they thought that, yes, it gets so much traffic that somebody clearly lost a quarter in here. That's the kind of people they are. They are bottom feeders and they live completely on the fringe of society. And in a weird way, they're this tight-knit group, but they also have no love among them. They exist just to run the grift. And Richard Jenkins does a fantastic deadpan job in his role. Deborah Winger plays the mom, and she almost looks not Amish, but like almost just sort of crazy in the sense she has this long hair and always has this long dress. Evan Rachel Wood plays her daughter, and it focuses on her as a character because Evan Rachel Wood, first of all, Evan Rachel Wood's a beautiful woman. And I think she's trying to deliberately play against type. I mean, she's playing this very plain character with this long hair that covers most of her face. And she wears sort of this warm-up tracksuit the whole time. And looks frumpy as all get out and talks like this through the whole movie because she doesn't have any sort of expression whatsoever. And that's the kind of characters that these people are. Well, when this character played by Gina Rodriguez shows up and wants to be part of it, it excites them. The parents are somehow interested in somebody other than their own kid. And then Evan Rachel Wood's character is intrigued with this new woman, this new addition to their potential clan. And it shows how that will eventually fall apart and how when you get involved in a criminal element, you all kind of have to have the same level of distaste because someone's always going to want to push it beyond that. And if you don't have the same level of distaste, at some point you're going to turn off the other people in the mix. And that's ultimately what's going on. And it shows this weird downfall of Gina Rodriguez's character, but also this allure that she has to Evan Rachel Wood's character who wants something more. So it's a bit of a coming out of her shell movie, but it's also just a quirky, weird, very dry comedy. And works about 50% of the time. The rest of it is almost a little bit forced in how they do it. So overall, I mean, it's interesting. But like I said, it's for fans who want that 90s independent film feel to it. For me, it didn't quite connect. So I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks. But it might be for some people.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Enola Holmes. Millie Bobby Brown stars as Enola, the sister of Master Detective Sherlock Holmes, who is on the search for her missing mother.
A week ago, I awoke.
Mother?
To find that my mother was missing, and she did not return.
I'm presently on the way to collect my brothers, Mycroft and Sherlock.
Yes, Sherlock Holmes, the famous detective, my genius brother. He will have all the answers.
A wild woman brought up a wild child. Who will make her acceptable for society?
She seems intelligent.
It is time to find my mother. The game is afoot.
This is on Netflix, and it actually came out on Wednesday, so you may have already had a chance to see it. It's another attempt to do a version of Sherlock Holmes, but does a different spin. I believe it's based on a book. And it is all centered on Millie Bobby Brown. Now, most people recognize her from playing Eleven in Stranger Things. And one of the things with Stranger Things is, especially in the first season and a little bit of the second season, she didn't give much of a chance to act. But by the time she got to the third season, she was really getting a chance to develop a character. Here she actually gets a full development of character. She gets to use a British accent, which I don't know if she has a natural British accent. I know she was born in England and she's lived in America. I've not met her personally, so I don't know. But this is a sweet little movie, mainly because she carries it. She holds the movie together. She has charm and a wit and a smile, stuff you don't really get to see in Stranger Things. She's not given much of a chance to show the softer side of herself in Stranger Things, or even in that Godzilla movie. That even though I like that Godzilla movie they made last year, she didn't get a chance to really shine as an actor in it. But she works in this one, and you know, I'm a bit of a sucker for Sherlock Holmes type movies, and this gives a version of it. It reminds me a little bit of that movie, Young Sherlock Holmes, which is, by the way, a fantastic film. If you've not seen it, it kind of flopped in the 80s, but it's a really interesting movie. But this gives her a chance to play around in that world without having to be shackled to all the elements of Sherlock and Watson that you normally see in a film. And so it's her to have her own little adventure in Victorian London, which is kind of cool. And they do bring in some of the other characters, like they bring in Sherlock and Mycroft. Mycroft's played by Sam Chaffin, and then there's Henry Cavill as Sherlock Holmes. Henry Cavill plays a lousy Sherlock Holmes, by the way. It's just he's a good-looking guy, but he's kind of a bland, boring actor, I've always felt. He just kind of blends it in, which is kind of what he does with everything he does. He's one of my least favorite Sherlocks just because he's boring on screen. But it's made up for the fact that Millie Bobby Brown, she's the glue that makes this thing work. She's the gem. She's the star. And she's the title character. So I'm going to have to say that I'd watch an entire series of Enola Holmes movies. Absolutely. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Misbehavior and the Secret Society of Secondborn Royals.
So sexy it hurts.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Misbehavior, or Misbehavior. It's spelled with a U. Misbehavior. And that's how you know it's British. A group of feminists plan to disrupt the 1970 Miss World competition in London.
Last year, 100 million people tuned in live to Miss World. More viewers than for the moon landings or the World Cup.
They must have no defects. And if they're not pretty much 36, 24, 36,
come on,
the curves won't be in the right places.
But we really believe beauty isn't just skin deep. The girls also get marks on charm, grace, deportment.
Swimsuits.
They're turning oppression into spectacle. Let's make a spectacle of our own. We'd infiltrate the theatre.
I was born in 1971, so I did not live through this. And whatever aftermath came from it, I was pooping my pants and playing with toys and not paying attention to the news. So this is sort of ancient history to me. And it's 50 years old from what this happened. Misbehavior stars Keira Knightley as this woman who is a feminist in London in the 1970s. And she joins this group of activists who want to disrupt this pageant. It's literally Miss World pageant. For those nowadays, you know, this is 50 years ago, apparently it was like a huge thing. It was like a big, 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 big deal. Now, most people in America think, oh, Miss America is the big thing. I remember occasionally swerving into it, but I always thought that they were stupid on TV. They were boring. You know, it made no sense watching a Miss America pageant as a kid, because I'm like, well, my gosh, my mom's Good Housekeeping magazine has better underwear ads than what you see in the swimsuit competition. Because at an early age, even I noticed it was just, it's a beauty contest. And now, oh, yeah, we care about what they think. No, we don't. When it comes to beauty contest movies, there's other better ones out there, like Miss Congeniality with Sandra Bullock. I also think Drop Dead Gorgeous is kind of interesting. That's one that came out, I think, the early 2000s, maybe like right around the turn of the century. This one is trying to walk this line between Keira Knightley's character dealing with these feminist activists in 1970 and Gugu Mbatha-Raw's character, who is a contestant from Grenada and has a chance to be the first black Miss World, which is a big deal. Because here's the thing. I remember in, what was it, 1983 or 82, when Vanessa Williams became the first black Miss America. That was a big deal. And historically looking at it, you'd be like, that's really a big deal? It's a beauty pageant. How hard is that? You know, so that was a big deal back then. And I remember Fall from Grace with the Penthouse magazine and everything like that. But that's the world that you live in, even though the whole Miss America stuff happened, you know, a dozen or so years later. But Gugu Mbatha-Raw is very good in it. And she does, they do try to show the point that she's saying, hey, this actually gives girls who look like me a chance to think that they can be beautiful too. And they also have to play out to the fact that the South African contestants, they brought in a white girl and a black girl. So it's trying to hit a lot of these social issues. And in a way it does. But what's so strange about it is I knew what the world was like in 1970. And like I said, I grew up in the 70s. So I saw it from a child's point of view, but I still look at this and I am flummoxed by who gives a flying crap about a beauty pageant. These things are stupid and they've always been stupid. And they've always been misogynistic and they've always been sexist. And the fact that nobody cares about them now is a good thing in our society. Oh, there's beauty pageants all over the place and you can still find them. But I mean, really, does anyone care about me? Do you know who Miss America is? Could you pick her out of a lineup? I mean, I would pick the most attractive woman and that would be it. Cause I'd be like, well, that's probably might be Miss America. So the fact that this exists as a movie is now 50 years later that you look at it and say it is absurd that I had to have this pointed out to them. There's a scene where Keira Knightley's on a talk show with these old farts and they're saying, oh, well, what's wrong? I like seeing beautiful women. And she's having to point out to them that, you know, their job doesn't depend on their attractiveness because he's an old fart and he's ugly and he's bald and he's fat and he's got gray hair. You know, so it's an interesting look into the world of 50 years ago, and I still have to just sit there and think, oh my God, this used to be a big deal. And I guess to some people it still is. But I think that's what the big joke is to me. That it's so absurd that people don't realize this. They're like, oh, how can you be offended by this? So I don't know. I guess that pretty much destroys my chance of ever being a judge in any beauty pageant, but I guess that's okay. Unless they wanted to pay me a percentage. But anyways, you know, Misbehavior, I think it's an interesting movie. And I certainly think it's worth looking at, especially from the world of today, 50 years ago, about what it's like. And realize there's a lot of people who are still alive when that took place. And to show just sort of like where the women's movement and feminism has grown and changed and developed over the last 50 years. So I'm going to say that Misbehavior kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the Secret Society of Secondborn Royals. A group of second children to royals around the world discover they have superpowers they need to save the world.
Good morning, class.
We are going to have fun this summer.
as members of the Secret Society of Secondborn Royals. You guys have superpowers.
We're superheroes.
Your abilities are unique to you alone.
For thousands of years, Secondborns like you have protected our kingdoms from threats.
He's more powerful than any of us. But he's not more powerful than all of us.
This is an exclusive on Disney Plus. Disney used to drive a lot of content to the Disney Channel. If you remember back in the day, like 15 years ago or something like that, they made that movie High School Musical, which was a Disney Channel movie, and it did extremely well. They did a sequel, and then they did a third one that actually made it to movie theaters, and it's one of the few times I can think of that a sequel made it to movie theaters with a number on it, High School Musical 3, and the very first one was never in theaters ever. But now Disney seems to be aiming all of their content development into Disney Plus. This appears to be aiming a slightly older demographic. One of the things with the Disney Channel movies is they went for the tween crowd. They went for the kids that are 10, 11, 12. This one looks like it's going for like the just turned teenagers, 13, 14, 15. I think the girl in it, she said she's 15 years old. That's sort of like the target market for it. And in that sense, it does have a higher production value. And it's a better movie than Artemis Fowl, which dropped on the service out of the pandemic timeline earlier this summer. This one's a little more fun. I mean, it does fit that formula, and it's that absurd formula that the second born of a royal family has some sort of genetic ability to do some amazing superpower. It's an absurd, ridiculous premise, but you know, it's a Disney movie. But once you get past that absurd, ridiculous premise, you know, the kids are funny in it. They have a good bit, and they have some neat action to it. You can tell it's still made on a restricted budget. They pick their money shots specifically, you know, if you want to talk about their, and they go more for the locations and the grandeur than for the special effects. They do a lot of stuff in camera, or they sort of cheat a little bit with the special effects. And that's cool. I mean, I enjoyed it. I actually thought this was kind of fun. This is the kind of thing that you'd expect, you know, for sort of like, like a young, maybe even less than a PG X-Men type introduction type movie, or something like, do you remember that film? There was this movie about 10, 15 years ago about kids who are superheroes in a high school. That one was really good. Or Zoom. That's the one with Tim Allen. That's kind of the level it's going for. I mean, you can't think too much about it. It's not meant to be a hard hitting movie, but it's a fun little movie. I enjoyed it. I was surprised. I enjoyed it more than I enjoy the standard Disney Channel movie, although I haven't watched an actual Disney Channel movie. They had those Descendants movies. I watched one or two, I think I watched the first two of those. And I thought those were clever enough, but they still had that cheesy Disney Channel vibe that this sheds a little, it still has that vibe, but it shed a bit of it. And it's cool. So, I mean, it's on Disney Plus right now. So if you have Disney Plus, if you already bought Mulan and you've already watched it enough time, you can watch The Secret Society of Second Born Royals. Surprisingly, I enjoyed it. I thought it kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Pen 15 Season 2 and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Clue and the original The Hound of the Baskervilles. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and do a final one, which is actually a TV series that's on Hulu. It's called Pen 15. If you don't know why it's called that, write it on your forehead in a Sharpie marker and somebody will tell you. But season 2 is now available. Maya and Anna struggle through more preteen angst in the year 2000 in middle school.
I just think the real thing is that we've changed.
Like, Brant and I, he doesn't really know it yet, but we want time alone together.
Is that your hair?
No.
Is that Brant's locker?
No.
Maya?
I think we are on another level.
I'm sorry, I'm just hormonal.
You're the one that wanted a divorce.
You think your parents are gonna keep splitting the house in half?
Probably. We're like still family.
She's my best friend on God's green frickin' earth.
The catch of this series is it's two women in their 30s who are playing themselves essentially in middle school. They were 12 or 13 in the year 2000, and this is their life. And what's funny is the character Maya, who's half Japanese, her mother, her actual mother, plays her mother in the movie, which is why her mother is oddly old in this. I mean, because she's the mother of a woman in her 30s, and she's supposed to be a, you'd think a woman who has a 13-year-old daughter would be late 30s, early 40s, but no, the mother's like in her 50s or pushing 60 at least. But it's a cute little show. I saw it categorized on Hulu as cringe comedy, and that's absolutely true, because it's less about the story and the plot, and it's more about the character and the reality of what it was like to be a 12 or 13-year-old girl in 2000. Now, in case you haven't noticed, I am not a 13-year-old girl, nor have I ever been a 13-year-old girl. But I did live with a 13-year-old girl because I have a sister who's 2 years older than me. In the movie Lady Bird, if you remember the movie Lady Bird, there's a scene where they go shopping. And Lady Bird has a complete meltdown in front of her mom, and then it spins 180 degrees, and they say, oh, look at this top. Isn't this cute? And that's exactly the emotional structure of a 13-year-old girl. That's what it's like to be in puberty, let alone being a girl in puberty. And so that's what this series completely captures, that fragility and the powerful hormonal explosive angst that is felt, and the fact that anything tiny is the biggest thing in the world to this age. And there's such truth there. And it's uncomfortable to watch because it's like watching people going through middle school, which is never comfortable to watch. And you have flashbacks to what it was like when you were a kid, and it's all the problems that girls have, you know, when to start shaving and, you know, when they start developing and, you know, when they have to buy a bra and, you know, when do they change from this kind of panties to that kind of panties? And, you know, do I look okay? And oh my gosh, I got to have braces or a retainer. Is my hair okay? I'm getting a zit. All this kind of stuff, which is just, most people forget about that nonsense when they're older. This is the essence of being a preteen girl or a teenage girl, and that is what Pen 15 captures perfectly in telling its story, and that's why this is such a funny but cringe-worthy show. So if you have Hulu, it's I think only 7 episodes, half hour each. It's worth checking out. I enjoy it. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That's how it means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first movie I want to talk about is Clue, which is, of course, based on the classic board game, and it came out in 1985. We recently cleaned out my parents' basement, you know, because my father had passed this summer, and we had a box, a Clue box, and so we brought it up to my house, and I wanted to keep it because they've changed Clue. Clue has a little more rules now. It has other cards. And so I said, let's keep Clue from this old one if you want to play the old-fashioned version of Clue. And so my son likes mystery shows. He loves Monk and Psych and stuff like that. So I said, you'd like Clue. Let's watch Clue. And it was neat because it gave me a chance to revisit a time in my life, because it was made in 1985 when I was maybe just a little bit older than him. But anyways, Clue, I'll play the trailer for you here. The classic board game comes to life in this murder mystery with multiple endings.
Every person in this room has the perfect motive.
Stand back!
For murder.
What do you mean? Murder.
But only one of these suspects is the murderer. Paramount Pictures invites you to an evening of mystery, murder.
This is getting quite serious.
And madness. In the movie that makes a scene of the crime, Clue, it's not just a game anymore.
What was neat about being able to show him this movie is I was able to introduce him to some actors that are no longer, well, some of them are still with us, like Christopher Lloyd and Michael McKean. Others aren't, like Madeline Kahn. I'm pretty sure Elaine Brenneman is not anymore. Tim Curry is pretty much not working anymore because he had a stroke. But there's a lot of actors in that were classic 80s actors, but also just comedians at the time. I mean, Michael McKean, Christopher Lloyd, Madeline Kahn. You had Leslie Ann Warren. These are very, very funny people who never really got known much past 2000, some of them. Or when they moved past 2000, like Michael McKean, he became much more of a dramatic actor. And it gave me a chance to sort of introduce my son, who's 12, to some of these classic comedic actors. And that was a lot of fun. And to show him sort of like what the setup for a comedy movie was in the 1980s. The other thing that's neat about it, and a lot of people know this about the movie, especially if you've seen it, it had the greatest catch. And the catch was it had three different endings. And depending on what theater you saw it in, you saw a different ending. And at first, I remember when it came out, they didn't tell you. It just, you went to one. And I remember I went to one and I saw an ending, and then I went to another theater and saw a different ending. And then after it'd been out for a couple weeks, they labeled them A, B, and C, and they told you which showing was going to be which ending. And that way you could, you know, kind of catch up if you missed one or two. But that was a neat little catch, and it was a neat little thing. And then they have them all kind of crammed together because it's on, I think it's on Prime. You can watch it for free. If you have Amazon Prime. But even I remember when the DVD came out, or VHS back in the day, they dropped all three endings into the very end. They said, or it could have happened this way. But it was a neat little movie. It's funny. It's clever. I think it holds up a lot better than it did. It kind of was a flop when it came out. And now looking back on it, seeing such a great cast working together, it's a great thing to revisit. So if you're at all a fan of the comedians of yesteryear, sort of like that Mel Brooks level of, it wasn't even all Mel Brooks comedians, but it's that time of comedians when Mel Brooks was at his height. He had nothing to do with this movie, but that's who I associate with some of these characters. That's the kind of person you want to watch this movie. It's a lot of fun. It's worth checking out. I'm going to say Clue kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. One final movie I want to hit really quickly is The Hound of the Baskervilles. Sherlock Holmes takes on a case of a wealthy family who seems to be haunted by a mysterious and vicious killer dog.
Mr. Holmes, I'm in mortal fear Sir Henry's life will be snuffed out.
Why, what makes you think that?
I have information which leads me to believe that for centuries past, every Baskerville who's inherited the estates has met with a violent and sudden death.
Now, will you please tell me what this is all about?
Dr. Mortimer thinks that it might not be safe for you to go down there.
Safe?
On account of a hound. A wild, supernatural monster that has cursed you Baskervilles for the last 200 or 300 years.
The reason I'm watching this movie is I realized when I watched Enola Holmes is I had never watched any of the old Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes movies. I may have read one Sherlock Holmes book, like way back in college, but I'm not well read of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's work, but I'd seen plenty of Sherlock Holmes adaptations, and I've always had conversations with my mother, who's a big mystery fan, and I said, well, I liked Benedict Cumberbatch. I thought he was great. I thought Robert Downey Jr. was okay, and she's like, oh, I don't like any of them. She liked old Basil Rathbone, and I wanted to go back and watch these, and the thing with The Hound of the Baskervilles is the story moves on, and Sherlock Holmes, played by Basil Rathbone, is quite good and prominently displayed without a lick of cocaine in him, because, of course, he was a drug addict in the stories and in the more modern movies. But he was more of just, you know, very with it and very composed. And Sir Basil Rathbone completely rules that screen. And it's back in, I think, 1939 that it came out. But there's like a 15-20 minute segment in there where he disappears. Watson goes on with the rest of the family to the Baskervilles, and he left without Sherlock Holmes. And boy, the movie just comes to screeching halt. Without Basil Rathbone in this movie, it's just boring. But when Sherlock Holmes shows up again, that kind of energizes the movie. And this is a neat little movie to watch. I think it might be in the public domain. So it's worth checking out if you want to go check out good old fashioned Sherlock Holmes in the original way he was presented in Hollywood. So I'm going to have to say that the original version of Sherlock Holmes, The Hound of the Baskervilles, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Also available this week are a bunch of vintage releases, including The Crow, Full Metal Jacket on 4K, the Scream 3 movie collection, and the Vincent Price collection, including The Pit and the Pendulum, The Abominable Dr. Fives, The Haunted Place, and The Fall of the House of Usher, along with The Mask of the Red Death and Witchfinder General. There's also DC's Legend of Tomorrow Season 5 and Rick and Morty Season 4. And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Glorias, Possessor, and On the Rocks. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.